this is 1, 2, 2, 3, 3. So let me say, my name is Jaume Gomis. I'm a faculty member here. My office, actually I forget my office. Is it 427 or 456? I don't know. I forget. It's in this side, in that side of the building, in the old building. Good. I mean, so you can come and ask me questions, but I much prefer if you ask me questions during the lectures or after the lecture, just because if you have a question that you're, if there's something you're confused about, there's at least one other person that is confused about exactly the same thing. So it's better if we discuss it during the lectures. Regarding the lectures, I believe there are some lecture notes that you may have access to that have been compiled from over the years from taking the course. I have not written them myself, so I cannot vouch for everything that's written there, but approximately everything should be there. Again, I didn't go through it very carefully to know that all the statements are correct, but at least it can be helpful. And then, it's a course that it's hard to find a textbook that would be really suitable. So I do the kind of idiosyncratic thing, so it's not so easy to just follow a textbook. That would be, I think, boring. But maybe these lecture notes, and whenever there is a material that I think a textbook could be useful, I'll mention it. Okay. Good. So before we start with, okay, and today's lecture is essentially going to be more of an like overview of what the subject that I'm going to be teaching about is, just to give you a perspective of why this subject is kind of important in specifically, but also in our understanding of theoretical physics. And then the next time we will start with like the details, like more constructive way of setting up things. So before we start with the lecture, are there any questions about organizational things? Did I forget to say something, Dan, or no? Oh, I guess you have tutorials that you have to do and so on, yeah. If you find the tutorials too easy, you can tell me and I can give you more sophisticated problems. But I can always do that. Oh, one thing you should also say, if you don't stop me, I have the habit of speaking very fast. So if you don't stop me, I'll accelerate probably. So it's in your benefit that you stop me once in a while. All right, so what's the subject of the course? So let me just, this is the main core of the subject. I will discuss many other topics along the course, but kind of the skeleton is conformal field theory. That usually people use the acronym CFT, okay? So that's the main subject of the course. This course has a peculiarity that it's in some ways challenging because it puts together many of the things that you have seen already before that look completely disconnected, but they come together. So here we will see that things you've seen in statistical mechanics, in general relativity, and quantum field theory are kind of all come together in one structure. So if you have not understood all steps in all these other subjects, it will be a bit challenging. But in a way, it's gratifying to see that these are not random subjects, that they're all part of some edifice. So that's one aspect of it. And so today, essentially, I'm going to try to explain essentially what we want to study conformal field theories. And there are many, many answers to this, but I'll give you some of them that I find particularly interesting. Okay. So, in the broadest possible terms, a conformal field theory is a quantum field theory with additional space-time symmetries. beyond the ones that you are familiar with, that you have already studied. And here I want to emphasize the word space-time symmetries. This is to distinguish from internal symmetries that act, say, on internal degrees of freedom that your physical system may have. Like, for example, if you study a gauge theory, a gauge theory, and you have a M scalar fields, there is going to be a flavor symmetry that rotates the scalar fields as you have a symmetry. That's an internal symmetry, and that's to be distinguished from a space-time symmetry, which is a transformation that acts on coordinates, space-time coordinates. Okay. Now, what are the space-time symmetries that you're familiar with? Can you give me a couple of examples of space-time symmetries you're familiar with? Poincaré. And essentially, for example, in Peskin and Schroeder, to give you, for example, a quantum field theory pretty much is any field theory that has as a space-time symmetry, Poincaré symmetry. Actually, to be more precise, it has the connected component of the Poincaré symmetry, okay? Is there some other space-time symmetry that you're familiar with? It existed before relativity. Galilean symmetry, yeah. So you probably maybe not have studied this so much in your field theory courses, but there are many physical systems in nature that are described that do not have relativistic symmetry, but have Galilean symmetry. And you can also write down quantum field theories with that symmetry. Okay? And these are important in many places, like in condensed matter physics. Okay. So essentially, a conformal field theory is a theory that has this symmetry plus additional ones. Okay. And now one thing that we know, probably you, by now you're already very familiar with, is that symmetries in physics are very important because essentially they allow us to parametrize what the answer to physical problem is. The more symmetries you have, the more you can constrain the dynamics. So for example, and that's even true in classical mechanics. So for example, this is just a small parenthesis about symmetries. So more symmetries, one thing that we will see in this course is that in conformal field theories, because you have additional symmetries, we will be able to essentially, using the constraints from symmetries and some basic physical principles, essentially reduce the problem of solving the theory. By solving means writing down all correlation functions of the theory to an algebraic problem, essentially. We're ever talking about Feynman diagrams and stuff like that, okay? And that's part of this idea that symmetries are, the more symmetries your system has, the more constraints we can impose on the dynamics. So for example, in classical mechanics, you know, if you start with Newton's law, essentially. You know, so in order to solve for the dynamics of this system, you have to solve a second order differential equation, right? These are Newton's law. But if the potential is time independent, then you have a conserved energy. And now in order to solve for the dynamics, instead of having to solve for a second order differential equation, you can solve for a first order differential equation. If I give you the energy, a conserved quantity, then you just have to solve this equation. And in fact, and this is something that by later on in the course, you should be able to see that if actually you can even do better than that, if B of X is of a particular type, actually then there exists another conservation law, conserved quantity, such that the motion of the particle is completely, let's call it Q, such that we can go even one step further. So here we solved, we still have to solve a differential equation, right? We have to solve for x dot. But you have an additional conserved quantity, then actually the dynamics is completely determined algebraically in terms of the two conserved quantities, okay? Yes. Well, so that's, you'll have to discover. But when we go further, you will see that there is a very special potential that will have a very special property, which will be scale invariant, that will give rise to an extra conservation law that will allow you to solve. So essentially, what will happen is that the quantity Q will be written in terms of x dot. So then you'll be able to solve for x dot in terms of Q. So that the critical symmetry here is that for a special, there exists a BX for which BX is a scale invariant, which I'll go, of course, I'm just using words now that I haven't explained yet, but since you asked. And in a couple of lectures, you'll be able to tell me what's the form of the potential that has this property. Okay? So this is just a simple example. In quantum field theory, it's the same. So in quantum field theory, if we're going to have more symmetries, we'll be able to constrain more and more things. Okay? So now I'm going to tell you a statement without proof. And you could say, okay, well, why did I stop with a conformal symmetry? Why don't I try to construct a bigger symmetry, a space-time symmetry than a conformal field conformal symmetry? And that, and what I'm going to say now is that conformal transformations is the largest possible symmetry that a non-trivial theory can have. And by non-trivial means a theory that is not a free field theory, essentially. So that's why conformal field theories, in a sense, is an upper bound of what are the possible space-time symmetries that the system can have. So it's the largest space-time symmetry QFT can have. So here I should say conformal symmetry. So conformal symmetry is the symmetry group of a conformal field theory, just to define terms. Okay. Okay, here there is a little bit of a lie. If you allow yourself to have symmetries that are generated by odd variables, which you haven't seen yet, but essentially, if you have supersymmetry, essentially, then actually the largest symmetry, instead of being conformal, can be upgraded to superconformal. So this is the addition when you have supersymmetry, which is a symmetry that relates bosons and fermions. Plus conformal. So if you have this addition, if you have supersymmetry, the largest possible symmetry, non-trivial theory can have a superconformal. If you don't have supersymmetry, conformal is the largest one. Yes?
Is this
yes, here I'm talking about Poincaré invariants. Yes. Yeah, in fact, we will very soon forget about the Galilean invariant case, yeah, but this definitely. And I'm not sure to what extent there are analogous theorems like this in the non-relativistic sense. It would be interesting to see if one can say something, an analogous thing. You can certainly have non-relativistic, conformal, and supersymmetric theories. But I'm not sure. It's the issue is whether you can have something beyond that is non-trivial. And my guess is that the answer is no, because then you have other currents that constrains things so much that essentially all the possible correlations that you can have are the ones of a free field theory. That's essentially the logic of it. Okay. Good. So we landed on, so we discussed briefly how powerful symmetries are, and the statement I'm making now is that conformal symmetry is essentially the largest possible symmetry that a conformal field theory could have. Okay. Okay. So now, but now I have to tell you a little bit what am I talking about with this conformal symmetry. So let's discuss conformal transformations. So as I said, I mean, we will go very carefully through this later, but essentially these are space-time transformations. So if I call, let me not do that. Let me discuss first a simple example of one that you'll have an intuition for, which are scale transformations. And actually, in physics, it's very important to think about scale. I mean, either implicitly or explicitly, whenever we discuss a physical system, we usually have in mind the length scale that we're starting the system at. Depending on our resolution of our microscope, depending on what energy scales are we interested in probing, we will describe a physical system differently. For example, if you're trying to study a tap of water, depending on the energy scale that you will want to probe, it will be sufficient to study hydrodynamic equations. If you're at a kind of a longish length scales, longer, say, than the molecule size of the water. Now, if you go to shorter length scales, you start seeing the granularity of the atoms and the molecules. So you will need to go from hydrodynamics to some more quantum mechanical description. But even more, if you go to even shorter distances, then you see that that atoms are made out of quarks and electrons and gluons and all of that stuff. And then you need yet a further description. So whenever we discuss a physical system, even though sometimes you don't think about it, you in your head have said, okay, I'm studying the system in this regime of energy scales. And then you try to find out what is an appropriate description of the system for that energy scale. In principle, you could have solved for the macroscopic properties of water by solving the Schrödinger equation, but that's not very useful. Okay, so you need to find an effective description. And the fact that physics can kind of separate it in scales is kind of very important also conceptually. And the fact that things kind of, the physics at different scales kind of separate, it's very important to the humans being able to make progress, because if you want to study water, we don't need to know about quantum gravity, right? Or we don't need to know even about macroscopic scales. We don't need to know about quantum mechanics. Okay, so the fact that things decouple, that if we want to study the physics of a system at some fixed energy scale, we don't need to know, you know, with arbitrary precision what happens at extremely short distances. And that's a good thing, because otherwise we'd have to solve the whole thing before we could solve anything. So, and the reason that these words are true and why this happens is the idea of the renormalization group that presumably you have studied to a certain extent. That usually when you study a physical system at some energy scale, you can parameterize the unknown properties at very short distances by a few coupling constants of relevant operators. And those coupling constants essentially is just a finite set. So given a set of degrees of freedom, you write down the most general theory that you can write down with those degrees of freedom. And the ignorance of what happened at very short distances essentially is encoded in a few coupling constants that we do not have to compute from the low energy theory, but that essentially parameterize our ignorance about the very short distance theory. Anyway, so we always think about scales. Mathematically, how do we think about scales? So what we say is that we rescale the space coordinate this way, and a priori we could rescale the time coordinate in this way. Okay, where Z is a critical dynamical exponent. Okay. Now, in relativistic, can someone tell me in relativistic quantum field theory what is the value of Z? One, because the transformation has to be isotropic. So I'll use mu to display the relativistic d vector. But in non-relativistic systems, z can be different from one. So can someone tell me an example of a theory that you know very well that has a non-trivial critical dynamical exponent different from one? Yes? No, the Ising model is relativistic at the fixed point. So exactly, just the free Schrodinger equation. If I write the free Schrodinger equation, it's minus nabla square by 2 psi equals I psi dt. You probably have never thought about this carefully, but actually this equation, the Schrodinger equation without a potential, and actually with a very special potential that you will discover, has a scale symmetry. And the right scaling behavior requires that z equals 2. So a scale symmetry can be present in relativistic as well as non-relativistic systems. But now from now on, for good or for bad, we're going to just focus on relativistic quantum field theories. Okay. So that's just an example of a scale transformation, and you have a very clear intuition is you can either zoom out in distances, which does the opposite in energy scales. Okay. But more generally, what is a conformal transformation? Essentially, is exactly this is a question you could ask in just pure geometry, even devoted of any physics. Essentially, is a space-time transformation. So x mu are the coordinates of Minkowski space. So now for today, actually for most of the lectures, unfortunately, we're in Minkowski space. So let's be in Minkowski space, and x mu are the coordinates in Minkowski space. So a conformal transformation is a space-time transformation where x mu goes to, in general, a nonlinear function of the coordinates. So in this example of a scale transformation, it was a linear transformation, right? So essentially, x tilde was linear in x. Do you know? OK, yeah. Such that angles between vectors are preserved but not necessarily distances. Okay. So that under this transformation, essentially the length element, the relativistic length element, yes. No, that's not what, no, that was not my definition. That was a property of conformal.
So are you saying, like, if we have a symmetry of these conformal transformations, that is the largest space?
This is the definition of what a conformal symmetry is. So it's essentially, so the logic is this. First you say, find the most general set of transformations of this type that preserves angles. What does preserve angles mean? It means that, but not distances necessarily, is that you exchange, the transformation makes the metric change by just an overall factor that can be x dependent. This clearly preserves angles because it's isotropic. When you measure angles, essentially you take ratios of metric element components, right? So this guy will drop out, essentially. And now the second statement is that now you have to solve this problem, and we were going to solve it in the next lecture. And then the second statement that it's a non-trivial statement, I don't claim I have proven it, that set of transformations is the most general one that has a non-trivial matrix, a correlation function. So for example, for Poincaré, so this clearly includes Poincaré, right? So it includes. So can someone tell me what sigma is for Poincaré? Zero, yeah, because in Poincaré you'll preserve also you preserve the line element. So not only you preserve angles, you preserve distances. And then here, one example that we saw is that we have a scale transformation. Technically, we also call it dilatation, under which ds square goes to lambda square ds square. Okay. And the thing that we will show in the next lecture, actually, you could say, well, this seems like an extremely general problem. I can dream up arbitrarily fancy functions of nonlinear functions of x, such that this is true. But what we will show is that the set of such transformations is finite dimensional. At least, okay, with the caveat if we're in space-time dimensions bigger than two. Something special happens in two dimensions that we will see. Okay. Yeah. Depends philosophically what you mean. I mean, I'm saying that in order to study turbulence, you don't need to know about quantum gravity. In a given physical system, you could have multiple scales that interact with each other. But I'm saying that if I take an energy scale that's much higher or much lower than the one you're considering, what happened at very high energies doesn't matter. You can solve the Navier-Stokes equations, or you can study turbulence without worrying about quantum gravity. That's essentially what I'm saying. So I was talking about I have in mind like the Planck scale. We don't have to care about the Planck scale for the LHC, for example. Yeah. Of course, in the actual details of you know materials and so on, a factor of 10 in a length scale can be very important. Yeah. But usually, even if the change of energy scales are you have several length scales, the RG philosophy allows you to kind of to organize what can happen. But yeah, no, I mean, scales obviously interact. Like even in the standard model, there are several energy scales and you know, they talk to each other for sure. It was more of a statement that you need to know everything to do something kind of, yeah, which is a good thing. All right, so later on we will see that we will solve this problem completely and find out the most general set of transformations. And we will find, actually, surprisingly, that even though this could have been the most general nonlinear function of x, in order to solve the most general solution to this problem, actually, only allows transformations that are at most quadratic in the coordinates. Okay? Good. Okay, so now, so hopefully, at least I gave you a flavor of what goes behind this subject. So now I'm going to try to answer in a few different ways. Why do we care about conformal field theories? And there are many answers. Let me give you ones that I think are interesting. So one thing you can ask about a physical system that you care about that has an intrinsic energy scale. Like QCD has an intrinsic energy scale, which is lambda QCD, which is the scale at which the strong interactions become strong. or the mass of the glue balls or so on. One thing you can always ask, given a system that has an energy scale, you can ask, what happens at asymptotically large distances? So essentially at distances much larger than any length scale that your system has, okay? Now, by definition, since you've zoomed out so much, there are no length scales left. So you're gonna get, from here, you're gonna get a scale invariant system. But it's useful to distinguish two possible things that can happen. Essentially, broadly speaking, there are two things that can happen. One is that if the system is gapped, so if the Hamiltonian of system has a gap, so this is the ground state, and you have some excited state, the first excited state, energy one, and there is a gap. Okay, let me say what I want to say. Okay, so if the system is gapped and you go to arbitrary long distances, what happens is that if you look at the correlation functions of local operators, so O of X is a local operator. In your system, can someone tell me in a system that has a mass gap or energy gap, how does the correlation functions in a system with a gap depend on the space, on space-time, on the separation between these operators? Think of a massive scalar field. What is the propagator of a massive scalar field? Sorry? Yes, so I'm asking, but physically, are the correlations, are the interactions between all of these two operators become small or large as you separate them if you have a mass gap? Become small. And, and actually, it decays exponentially, right? That's you have a mass term, you look at the proper, or the Yukawa interaction, right? So this goes like e to the minus x. And here there has to be some dimensionful quantity. Actually, let's call it the delta. Okay. So if I study the theory in the limit, in the extreme limit that I go to arbitrary large distances, in a theory with a gap, essentially, all operators, this quantity goes to zero, right? And essentially, O of X decouples in the infrared. Okay. So in that situation, it means that there do not exist local operators. So in a theory with a gap, at arbitrary large distances, there are essentially no local operators because all correlation functions decay exponentially, and in the limit, all operators, essentially because this guy should really be thought of as O on a dagger, so that the operator, so this is positive semi-definite, okay? And the operator decouples. So in this system, what you have is a potentially a theory that has no local operators. You would say that this is trivial, but actually, and this is very relevant not only in some systems in particle physics, but especially in condensed matter physics. So even though you don't have no local operators, there can exist non-local operators in the theory. And the low energy effective description of such a system is described, such a system is described by what is known by a topological quantum field theory. So this is a field theory whose correlation functions, essentially, or whose observables, including the number of ground states, depends not on the metric of the space, because there is no notion of metric. There is no real notion of points in this limit, right? There are no local operators. There is nothing that can measure local properties. So it's a theory that only knows about the global topology of your manifold. So for example, what could happen, and this happens in physical systems, is that you have a system that it has a gap in the spectrum, but the number of ground states, so imagine you study the theory, so imagine you have a system and you put it on a two-dimensional surface, okay? Now, the two-dimensional surface can have a non-trivial topology. You know that, for example, it could either be a sphere, or it can be a donut, genus, or a pretzel, or whatever, I mean, two holes. And the number of ground states of that system can depend on the genus of the surface, on the topology of the surface. That, the low energy description of such a system is precisely given by one of these topological quantum field theories, okay? So in a sense, these are theories that are very, very simple in that there are no local operators that survive in the extreme infrared, but nevertheless have non-trivial properties, have non-trivial degeneracy, for example. Okay. But that's not that could be the subject of one course, but the subject of the course will be the second possibility. Which is that the Hamiltonian of the system is gapless. Okay? So it means that, so in this system, actually, what you get is a system with a scale invariance, and actually, more generically, what you get here is a conformal field theory. Now, in a conformal field theory, now there are no energy scales left. So now what can happen is that the correlation functions of your theory, instead of having exponential decay, since there is no length scale in the system, what they have, and we will derive this, is power law dependence. And these deltas, which are going to be the scaling dimensions. Of the operators, which will be one of the main quantities that we'll want to be able to, we will want to learn how to compute in a conformal field theory, will be precisely these coefficients. I think you had a question, yeah.
What are examples of physical systems that topological
quantum field theories describe? So there are many, but you want one in condensed matter physics or in particle physics?
Yeah.
Okay, so. An example would be take a 2+1 dimensional QCD. So, for example, take SUN Young Mills coupled to a quark in the adjoint representation. Okay, that theory is believed to flow. So, if you look at this theory and you ask what happens in the deep infrared of this theory, what you get is a particular topological quantum field theory, which is of a Chern-Simons type. So in 2+1 dimensions, you can have a Chern-Simons. There's a very famous topological field theory that's called Chern-Simons theory. And this theory is believed to flow to a very specific Chern-Simons theory.
So you have topological field theory.
Yes. They're not as exciting as in 2+1 dimensions, but yes, you can have, like, they're called BF theories. Yes, you can have. But yeah, you can have them. And other examples are, so in 2+1 dimensions, again, is a very special place for topological quantum field theories. In condensed matter systems, there are these things called anions. Have you heard of these things? So these are particles that have fractional spin and fractional statistics. So essentially the dynamics of those theories, so you can have systems that at low energy, all that you have are these anions. Those are described by a topological quantum field theory. Like the fractional quantum Hall effect, for example. So the fractional quantum effect, you start with some crappy metal with electrons, blah, blah, blah. But at very low energies, what you get is one of these topological quantum field theories that describe the fractional quantum Hall effect. Again, actually, those are, in many cases, are the Chern-Simons type. Yeah. Yeah.
Understand that when the system is gapless, the correlations decay is much slower than the gap case, but it's still the decay. Correlations will be zero in the
Well, but yes, but it's polynomially, so it's kind of in a controlled way. I mean, something survives. The problem is that there is no scale here, right? So at large distances, it decays like 1 over x, but also at small distances. There is no such thing as large distance or a small distance in a theory that has no scale. So then you can ask, what happens when x is 1 meter? It's the difference between an exponential decay and a power law decay. I mean, that power law decay is something that you still can track. And there are non-trivial operators here. In particular, one of the most non-trivial operators that always survives in this case is the energy momentum tensor. For example, here, the energy momentum tensor in a topological quantum field theory. Okay, you must have seen what the energy momentum tensor in one of the previous courses. So this, for example, this guy can at most be a constant. Well, okay, so there's actually no operator. Actually, I'm typically zero. A constant is if you're in curved space-time, okay, but we're doing flat space here, so let's not worry about that. Here, the team you know actually has to be there because any space-time symmetry transformation is always generated by the energy momentum tensor. So this guy exists always. And I mean, we will derive why in a theory that is conformal, all correlation functions have this behavior. More questions? Okay. So essentially, we see that if we study, we ask this kind of, it's a simplifying question, but it's an important question of what happens if you have a physical system at asymptotically large distances. We see that one of the two options that are possible is that you get a CFT. Actually, there are not many options. Either you get a TQFT or a CFT. Of course, in many physical systems, you want to know more than the absolute limit of large distances. You want to study the spectrum. For example, you want to study this spectrum, right? All the lines here, you know. But that's hard. Given a physical system, that's hard. A simpler question to ask is, which is still extremely hard, and in general, we don't know how to answer. If I give you quantum field theory, most of them become strongly coupled, which means that you cannot study reliably using perturbation theory. You want to ask, what happens in the deep infrared? Do we know whether option one or option two happens? And given option one and option two, then you have to figure out which CFT or which TQFT is actually described. It's completely out of reach in general. Now, if you're strong, even stronger, then you can try to ask more finite energy scale, finite distance scale things, but that's even harder, okay? So this probes a limited set of questions, but already this is extremely hard, and in general, we don't know how to answer, okay? So let me give you a few examples so it doesn't sound so abstract of CFTs. So can someone give me an example of a theory that is a CFT on the nose? So a necessary condition for that is that the system that has no energy scale. So can someone tell me an example of a theory that you have studied that is a conformal field theory? Sorry? Vacuum. Yes, I don't know what the word vacuum means, but... with no source. Yeah, I mean, you can have the electron. Massless electron. Yes, okay. Okay, so QED. What else? Sorry? Yes, but that, yeah, of course, yes. Okay, so if we're in four space-time dimensions, I'm gonna write an equation of motion. Can someone tell me for which potential the system has no length scale? In four space-time dimensions. So let's say that B, okay, let me help you a little bit. Let's say that B of phi is lambda phi to the n. When is lambda dimensionless in four dimensions?
Central.
5-4, yeah. So for n equals 4, yeah. And et cetera. Actually, also that you have Young-Mills, the Young-Mills equations of motion are dimensionless and so on, okay? Now, but this is a statement about the classical theory, right? One thing that you know quantum mechanically is that virtual particles can induce on the coupling constants of the theory a scale dependence, right? So this is true classically, but quantum mechanically, you can have things like this that induce dependence of the coupling constant on the energy scale. And the theory, quantum mechanically, ceases to be a scale invariant. But nevertheless, there are theories that either flow from a system that has a length scale to a conformal field theory in the infrared, or there are theories that are conformal on the nodes. Typically, especially in four dimensions, that requires the presence of additional symmetries that make essentially loop corrections to the coupling constants vanish, and that's usually supersymmetry. Okay? Yeah.
Classically, what do you mean by classically?
Classically means, so these are the classical equations of motion, right?
Okay.
But you know, if in field theory, you can ask what are the effects of what is the effect of quantum particles, and typically what this does is, I mean, you must have seen the beta functions.
Yeah.
So the fact that, so these are only classically scale invariant. Quantum mechanically, they are not scale invariant unless you are in a special situation. Like for example, if you have Young-Mills theory and you put the right number of scalars and the right number of fermions, so say for example the theory is n equals 4 super Young-Mills, then the theory is conformal invariant on the nodes, even quantum mechanically. But if you just write down something, if you just on a piece of paper write something that classically has no dimensionful parameters, it's bound to not be true quantum mechanically, because quantum mechanically, virtual particles usually, unless there are other symmetries around, give a non-trivial energy dependence to the coupling constant that's measured by the beta function. So, and that's typically non-zero. Okay. Yeah.
It's about the drop system. The correlation function between the two loop operators, is it dependent on the details of the operators that we're using?
Yes, the coefficients in front, yes, but not the power law dependence, not the exponential dependence, though.
So the exponential dependence, whatever the operators we're looking at, is always controlled by
the gap, yeah. And one way to think about it is that what you do is you insert a complete set of states, and you know you have e to the I something or other, and that's where the exponential will come from. Yeah. Yes.
I want to make sure I know the right way to think about this, because in my mind also.
Yeah.
You kind of derive that from adding corrections to the function?
Yes.
But
okay.
That's like something else.
No, that's it is okay. Should
so
I go into?
Like an extra,
actually, the Wilson-Fisher fixed point exists precisely because lambda runs. And then essentially what happens, okay, so let me say it in words, I'm not sure how much in detail I want to go, but essentially what you do, first of all, you do something slightly kooky. You go, first of all, to 4 minus epsilon dimensions, right? Okay? Where epsilon is a small number. I know this sounds crazy, but this works, okay? I mean, when you compare with the anyway, yeah. So lambda phi to the 4, then lambda becomes relevant. Yeah, do you know this word of relevant irrelevant operators or not? Or should I review that? You're not familiar with that? No? Okay. It's hard to explain this without getting to that. But essentially, the point I'm making is that you start with this theory. Okay, you start with the free field theory that has lambda equals zero, right? Now you do a deformation So you have the Lagrangian of your world is lambda 3 plus lambda phi to the 4, okay? Now, this guy in 4 minus epsilon dimensions is slightly relevant because epsilon, you're not in 4 dimensions, you're slightly below 4 dimensions, so it makes it a little bit irrelevant. The Wilson-Fischer fixed point, so the fact that it's relevant means that the coupling wants to grow as you go to the infrared. I'm going to review that in a second. It wants to become, so usually we draw these flow diagrams. So I turn lambda, and the coupling wants to grow towards, go to the infrared. So the Wilson-Fischer fixed point is the statement that this flow ends, can end on another theory that is the scale invariant. But the theory that's scale invariant is not this, is the endpoint of this flow. So typically what can happen is you're going to have a CFT. You can deform by an operator, and then at the end of that flow triggered by that operator, you can get another CFT. That's what happens with the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. The Wilson-Fischer fixed point is the endpoint of an RSU flow of a free field theory deformed by lambda phi to the 4, and it flows. If you tune, of course, in order to hit here, you have to tune.
So would you say
the mass squared to go to 0, yeah.
Which that occurs depends on the
quantum fractions? Yes. Because, so this example is very simple in the sense that you can actually, typically, the fixed point that you get in the infrared, you cannot study in perturbation theory because the coupling constant becomes large as you go under a flow. Here we're cheating. The cheating is that we make epsilon arbitrarily small. So essentially, I make the flow extremely small. So lambda went from a very small value, didn't have time to grow, it's still a small value, okay? So the value of the coupling constant here at the fixed point, so to speak, is small. And it's controlled by epsilon, essentially. But in a generic RSU flow, that's not the case at all. But these are the class of examples in which you can study non-trivial RSU flows from one CFT to another, using perturbation theory. And of course, the beta function enters, because essentially the beta function is important because what are you solving here? You have the beta function of lambda. Now that you're in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, there is a, in 4 dimensions, the beta function of lambda is 0, right? We said that there is no scale dependence, but now that you're in 4 minus epsilon, it's actually slightly relevant, so it's minus epsilon lambda, okay? But now, and now you do this one loop business. Okay? So now here is going to be some lambda to some power, which we can figure out, times some number, okay? Some other number, A. What's the, let's say, what are we doing? Sorry, lambda phi to the 4, so. I think this is lambda square, probably. So what is the fixed point of this? Is when there is a zero of that function, right? But so here I'm using very, very specifically the beta function of the lambda phi to the 4 in 4 dimensions to determine the value of lambda at which there is a fixed point. So if you wish, lambda equals epsilon times the beta function that I would have fired in lambda phi to the 4 at one loop. Because I get the non-trivial CFT by putting this to 0. Yes, but it's quantum, but perturbative CFT. This is to be distinguished with most CFTs, like the Ising model. To give you an example, if you really want to get the Ising model out of this, and people try, I mean, people did, and they got Nobel Prizes for this, is you take this setup, and what you want to do is then take the limit epsilon goes to 1. But you can see that there's extrapolation. When you go to epsilon 1, the perturbative control is lost. So people do all kinds of tricks of Padre summations. It's a bit of voodoo, but it kind of works. We're going to do something much better. We're going to solve directly the CFT of the Ising model without ever knowing that it came from this. So the CFT is something that is a Platonic object that exists, and you do not need to know where it came from. So here it came from some cookie RSU flow that we kind of hacked, and then you do some extrapolation and you close your fingers and you hope for the better. But you can study the, like, so actually this CFT has to do with the Ising CFT if you go to three dimensions. Okay? The thing that we will see is that you can study directly this object without caring that it came from UV Lagrangian or anything. There's this object, there's a certain symmetry that acts on this object, which is the conformal symmetry, and we will just solve the theory by hitting it with a hammer with the symmetries. We will not care about where it came from, essentially. But if you are a perturbative person, you can there are some theories you can study in this way, where you by hand, by tuning something, you make an energy flow to be very short, so that at the fixed point, the coupling didn't have time to get too large, and then perturbation theory is still valid. Another family of examples of this type, so the one is this Wilson-Fisher. The other one is called Banks-Zaks. So these are energy flows that you can have in Young-Mills theory coupled to quarks. If you tune the number of flavors to be very, very large, you can construct a non-trivial zero of the beta function that's reliable, where the cage coupling is still small. That's an example, another example of a kind of perturbative, reliable, computable from things that you know, fixed point, as opposed to most CFTs that are living in somewhere. And if you try to use a definition of where they came from, you wouldn't be able to do it anyway, because it's very far away. And even if you have a UV definition, the theory becomes strongly coupled by the time you hit the fixed point. So you need some other tool to kind of study it. That was a long detour, but what can I do? Yes, so you want me to explain this relevant and irrelevant business? Yeah, okay. Now, I'm pretty sure you've seen this, but it will be good to, because that's another point that I want to discuss. So let me first say the slow one, and then I'll try to go back. So I'm trying to give you reasons why CFTs are important. Well, one is that anything that you write down, that you've written down, essentially, at least classically, is a CFT. So you should know about that. But essentially, another point I want to make is that CFTs induce an ordering in a space of quantum field theory, okay? But in order to review that, So you can ask the following thing. So imagine I start with a conformal field theory. Okay, this would be a good example. In this example, the original conformal field theory was just the free field theory, right? I started with the free field theory, and then I turned on some operator. And now I turn on some operator, O, okay? This is an operator in this CFT. So here, I started with the free field theory, so just d phi square, and I chose to add lambda phi to the 4. And now you ask, what happens? Now, what happens in the infrared depends very strongly on the dimension of delta, okay? So if the dimension of delta is bigger than the space-time dimension, the operator is called irrelevant. It means that it is unimportant in the infrared. So can you give me an example of an irrelevant operator in lambda phi to the 4 theory? Five what?
Four.
Yes, another one. So why is, say, phi to the 6 not important in the infrared? Can you say it in, like, qualitatively, why? That's one way of saying it. Another way of saying it, but maybe a more physical way of saying it is that if I add, so the say the phi to the 6 operator, lambda will have a negative mass dimension, okay? So imagine you do a scattering process. You have some incoming center of mass energy E. What you will get is that, let me see. This will scale like E to some lambda to some power. I'm just doing dimensional analysis. Lambda has, no, I did it wrong. So lambda, if the operator is irrelevant, has negative mass dimension, right? So in order to make something dimensionless, I have to multiply by powers of the energy. So I'm thinking of some scattering experiment. I have E is the center of mass energy. So now you can see that at low energies, when energy is small, this guy goes to zero. So that is energy, it's irrelevant, okay? Now, the other option is that delta is smaller than D, and then the operator is relevant, which is, it means that it's important in the infrared. So if you wish here, lambda has length dimensions, while here, lambda has what kind of dimension? Has positive mass dimension, right? Has mass dimension. And now you see that this argument also tells you the right answer, because now I have to do dimensional analysis, and for a relevant coupling, I'll have to have lambda has mass dimension, so I have to have lambda divided by E. But now what happens as E gets small? This becomes large. So a relevant operator affects dramatically low energies, while a relevant operator is irrelevant at low energies. Yes.
Why do we only care about the infrared?
Is this a philosophical question or technical question? I mean,
I don't know. It's like important in the infrared, but like, are there still like, Not
well, one reason that it's important is that the. Okay. Because that's usually how we work. We know description of the nature up to a certain energy scale. Mm-hmm. And then we ask, what can we describe? What you're asking is, what happens at the Planck scale? And the answer is, I don't know. Well, I know, but no one will do. No, I don't know. The problem is that flowing towards the UV is a very tricky business. It's not an extremely well-defined concept until you have like a well-defined short-distance theory. It's well-defined to say, to drop things, see what happens as you're going to infrared. It's not really well-defined to say if you go up, because you don't know what's up there, essentially. It's not really well defined mathematically what it even means. Let me tell you an example. I mean, why is this true? If you write down most operators in a quantum field theory that you know and love, are most operators irrelevant or relevant? Sorry?
Most are irrelevant.
Yes, so most of them are irrelevant. But if you want to flow to the UV, and get something non-trivial in the UV, you have to turn on irrelevant operators now. And there's an infinite number of them. And it's not really a well-defined process. While going to the infrared is well-defined, you get a finite number of operators, and you just let them go. I mean, still, it doesn't mean that we know how to solve this, but conceptually, and this is related to the issue of decoupling, that if you're a pathetic low-energy person, you can describe what happens in your world only knowing a few parameters, because these are the ones that matter for you as a low-energy person. Well, if you ask to go to the UV from this effective field theory point of view, you need to know about an infinite number of parameters or couplings, and there is no way to even organize that. So it's not symmetric going towards the UV and to the infrared.
Does the notion of relevant or irrelevant also depend on the first point?
Yes, so I'm telling you with respect to this fixed point. Yeah, what's relevant in one fixed point becomes irrelevant in this other one. For example, in this example of the Wilson-Fisher, lambda phi to the 4 was relevant near the Gaussian, it's called Gaussian because it's quadratic, free field theory, fixed point, but actually is irrelevant near this other fixed point. So that actually tells you something interesting. You would have to think, what happened to the scaling dimension of this operator around this point? Will it be bigger or smaller than 4? Will it be bigger? And it's something you can compute using Feynman diagrams. So one's irrelevance is someone's relevance. It's kind of very zen. Okay. When am I supposed to stop here, or I don't stop and I go until 4 o'clock, or? Oh, okay, then I should stop. Okay, I didn't get what I wanted, but it's fine. Okay, any other questions quickly? Yes.
Overview of when people.
Oh, when you ask questions about people, I don't know how to answer those, but. We can go from one to the other interchangeably. I mean, I use length scale and energy scale interchangeably.
Yeah, but like when did people start, like, I mean, maybe that's just in my mind that these are two different kind of communities talking, like, let's say, condensed matter people talking about length and then
No, but I mean, actually, the condensed matter people, I think, introduced beta functions before the particle physics types, and they had it with derivatives with respect to length scale. It's just the inverse derivative, essentially. But what's a more, what's the question, though?
I don't know, it just feels, I just think about them so separately, I realize, like, the energy, like,
I mean, they're related by Fourier transform, essentially.
Yeah.
Now, for example, in the scale transformation, I said that x mu changes like this, but p mu scales oppositely, right? So if lambda is small, so you probe shorter and shorter distances, you probe higher and higher energy scales. They're just one and the same language.